Johnny. Oh, God, Johnny. Daniel squatted beside him and reached out to touch the side of his throat just below the ear, feeling for the pulse of the carotid. It was an instinctive gesture, for the bullet entry wound in the back of Johnny's skull was conclusive. Johnny's skin was cool, and Daniel could not yet bring himself to turn him over and look at the exit wound. He let him lie a little longer and rocked back on his heels, letting his anger flourish to replace the enervating chill of grief. He cherished his rage. As though it were a candle flame on a dark night, it warmed the cold, empty place in his soul that Johnny had left. Daniel stood up at last. He played the torch beam on the floor ahead of him and stepped over the pools and smears of Johnny's blood as he went to the armory. The remote control for the generator was on the mains panel beside the door. Daniel threw the switch and heard the distant clatter of the diesel engine in the powerhouse down near the main gates to the camp. The diesel engine ran up to speed and settled at a steady beat. Then the generator kicked in and the lights flickered and bloomed. Through the window he saw the street lamps lining the driveway light up, and in their glow the acacia trees were vivid green and shiny with raindrops. Daniel fetched the bunch of keys that still hung in the lock of the Milner safe and strode through into the armory. Along with the .375 culling rifles, there were 5 AK-47 assault rifles on the rack. These were used on anti-poaching patrols when the rangers needed equivalent firepower to take on the gangs of poachers. Ammunition was stored in the cupboard below the gun rack. He unlocked the steel door. There were 4 magazines of AK ammunition in each pouched webbing belt hanging on the hooks. He slung one of these over his shoulder and then lifted an automatic rifle down from the rack and loaded it with deft movements. The old warlike arts once learned were never forgotten. Armed and angry, he ran down the veranda steps. "Start with the ivory godown," he decided. "They'll have been there for sure." He circled the burned-out building, searching for sign by the light of the street lamps, flashing his torch at anything that caught his attention. If he had allowed himself to think about it, he would have realized he was wasting his time. The only prints that had withstood the erosion of the rain were those protected by the overhanging veranda roof, a set of heavy tire tracks in the mud at the front entrance to the ivory godown. Even these were almost erased and only just recognizable. Daniel ignored them. He was after the gang, and they would not be using vehicles. Quickly he widened the circles of his search, trying to pick up an outgoing set of tracks, concentrating on the northern side of the camp's perimeter, for the gang would almost certainly head back to the Zambezi River. It was useless, as he had known deep down that it would be. After 20 minutes he gave it up. There were no tracks to follow. He stood under the dark trees and raged with frustration and sorrow. "If only I could get a shot at the bastards," he lamented. It meant little to him in his present mood that he was one man against 20 or more professional killers. Jock was a cameraman, not a soldier. He would be of no help in a fight. The memory of those mutilated bodies in the bedroom of the bungalow and of Johnny's shattered head overpowered all rational thought. Daniel found that he was physically shaking with the strength of his anger, and that put him on the road to recovering his scattered wits. "While I'm wasting time here, they're getting clean away," he told himself. "The only way to cut them off is on the river. I need help." He thought of the Parks camp at Mana Pools. The warden there was a good man. Daniel knew him well from the old days. He had an anti-poaching team and a fast boat. They could get downstream and patrol the river to catch the gang as it attempted to get back onto the Zambian side. Daniel was already starting to think logically as he started back towards the warden's office. From Mana Pools they could ring Harare and get the police to send in a spotter plane. He knew that speed was vital now. Within the next 10 hours the gang would be back across the river. However, he could not leave Johnny like that, lying in his own blood. It meant wasting a few more minutes, but he had to show him some last respect, and at the very least cover him decently. Daniel paused in the doorway to Johnny's office. The overhead lights were brutally explicit. They left nothing of the horror concealed. He set aside the AK-47 and looked around for a covering for his friend's corpse. The curtains over the front windows were green government issue, faded by sunlight, but they would do as a makeshift shroud. He took one of them down and went with it to where Johnny lay. Johnny's attitude was tortured. One arm was twisted up under his chest, and his face lay in a pool of thick, congealing blood. Gently, Daniel rolled him over. The body had not yet stiffened in rigor mortis. He winced as he looked at Johnny's face, for the bullet had come out through the right eyebrow. He used a corner of the curtain to wipe his face clean, then arranged him in a comfortable attitude on his back. Johnny's left hand was thrust into the front of his tunic, and his fist was tightly clenched. Daniel's interest quickened as he saw the balled-up sheet of paper in his hand. He prized Johnny's fingers open and freed the wad. He stood up, crossed to the desk, and spread the paper on it. He saw at once that Johnny had scrawled on it using his own blood, and Daniel shivered at the macabre characters. NJNC. The letters were childlike and crude, smeared and barely legible. They made no sense, although perhaps the J was an I. Daniel studied it. N-I-N-C. Nink. Nink? Still there was nothing obvious in the message. Either it was gibberish, or had some obscure meaning that only made sense to a dying man. Suddenly Daniel felt a stirring in his subconscious. Something was trying to surface. He closed his eyes for a minute to give it a chance. Often it helped to let his mind go blank when searching for an elusive idea or memory, rather than to harry the point and drive it further under. It was there, very close, a shadow just below his conscious mind, like the shape of a man-eating shark under the surface of a turgid sea. Nink. N-I-N-C, Nink. He opened his eyes again and found himself looking at the floor. There were bloody footprints left by his own boot soles and by those of the killer. He was not thinking about them. He was still grappling with that single cryptic word that Johnny had left for him. Then he found his eyes had focused on one of the footprints, and his nerves jumped tight and shrieked like the strings of a violin slashed with the bow. The footprint was checkered with a fish-scale pattern. Nink! It sounded through his mind, and then that distinctive footprint turned the sense of it, and the echo came back altered and compelling. Ning! Johnny had tried to write Ning! Daniel found that he was cold and trembling with the shock of the discovery. Ambassador Ning! Ning Cheng Gong? How was it possible? And yet there were the bloody footprints to confirm the impossible. Ning had been here after Johnny was shot. Ning had been lying when he said that he had left. Daniel broke that train of thought as another memory struck him like a bolt from a crossbow. The blood on the cuff of the blue cotton slacks, the tracks of Ning's training shoes, and the blood, Johnny's blood. At last his rage had a target on which to focus. But now it was a cold, constructive rage. He pressed the bloody note back into Johnny's hand and folded his fingers around it for the police to find. Then he spread the green curtain over Johnny's body, covering the shattered head. He stood over him for a few seconds. "I'll get the bastard for you, old friend. For you and Mavis and the babies, I promise you, Johnny. On the memory of our friendship, I swear it." Then he snatched up the rifle and ran from the office, down the steps to where Jock waited beside the parked Land Cruiser. In the few seconds that it took him to reach the truck, the last details fell into place in his mind. He remembered Cheng's perturbation when he thought Daniel might be staying longer at Chiwewe, and his obvious relief when he learned that Daniel was leaving. He glanced back towards the ruins of the ivory go-down, and the tire treads were still just visible in the mud. It was simple and ingenious. Let the gang of poachers draw the pursuit, while they ferried the ivory out in the Parks Board's own trucks. Daniel remembered the surly, unnatural behaviour of Gomo and the other driver when he had met them on the road. Now it made good sense. They had been sitting on a load of stolen ivory. No wonder they were acting strangely. As he slipped behind the wheel of the Land Cruiser and ordered Jock to climb aboard, he glanced at his wristwatch. It was almost 10 o'clock, nearly 4 hours since he had passed Cheng and the trucks on the escarpment road. Could he catch them before they reached the main highway and disappeared? He realized that it had been so carefully planned that they must have worked out an escape route and some means of disposing of the ivory. He started the Land Cruiser and hit the gear lever. "You aren't going to get away with it, you dirty bastard!" In many places the recent storm waters had scoured the escarpment road, gouging knee-deep gullies across the tracks and exposing boulders the size of cannonballs. Daniel pushed the Land Cruiser over them so violently that Jock seized the grab handle on the dashboard for support. "Oh, slow down, Danny, damn it. You'll kill us both. Where the hell are we going? What's the rush?" In as few words as possible, Daniel told him the bare outlines. Well, you can't touch an ambassador, Jock grunted as the bouncing truck slammed the words out of him. If you're wrong, they'll crucify you, man.
I'm not wrong, Daniel assured him. On top of Johnny's note, I feel it in my guts.
The rainwaters had rushed down the slope of the escarpment, but when they had reached the floor of the valley, they slowed and piled up upon themselves. Only hours before, Daniel had crossed and recrossed a dry riverbed at the foot of the escarpment. Now he pulled up on the approach to the ford and stared down the beam of the headlights.
"Oh, you'll never get through there," Jock muttered with alarm.
Daniel left the motor running and jumped down into the ankle-deep mud. He ran to the edge of the crazy water. It was the colour of creamed coffee, racing past in a muddy blur, carrying small tree trunks and uprooted bushes with it. It was almost 50 yards across. One of the trees growing beside the ford draped its branches out over the torrent, in places just touching the swirling waters with its lowest twigs. Daniel grabbed the main branch for support and let himself down into the river. He edged out across the flood, and it took all the strength of his arms to prevent himself from being swept away. The drag of the water was overpowering, and his feet were continually lifted clear of the bottom. However, he worked himself out to the deepest section of the river. It was as deep as his lowest rib. The branch to which he was clinging was creaking and bowing like a fishing rod to the strain as he began to work his way back to the bank. He emerged from the torrent with water streaming down his lower body, his sodden clothing clinging to his legs and his boots squelching.
"It'll go," he told Jock as he clambered back into the cab. "You're crazy mad," Jock exploded. "I'm not going in there." "Okay, fine. You've got just 2 seconds to get out," Daniel told him grimly, and changed the gearing of the Toyota into four-wheel drive and low ratio.
"You can't leave me here," Jock howled. "The place is lousy with lions. What happens to me?"
"That's your problem, mate. Are you coming or going?"
"Okay, go ahead. Drown us."
Jock capitulated and grabbed the sides of his seat. Daniel rolled the Land Cruiser down the steep approach to the ford and into the brown waters. He kept her rolling at an even pace, and within a few yards the water was above the level of the wheels. But still the nose of the truck was tilted steeply downwards as the bottom fell away. There was a whoosh of steam as water rushed through the engine compartment and swamped the hot metal of the block. The headlights were obscured as they sank below the surface, becoming two luminous glows in the turgid water. A bow wave rose ahead of the bonnet as the water came up to the level of the windshield. A petrol engine would have swamped and stalled, but the big diesel pushed them stolidly forward into the flood. Water was pouring in around the doorposts. They were calf-deep where they sat.
"You really are crazy," Jock yelled and put his feet up on the dashboard. "I want to go home to Mother."
Now even the Land Cruiser was faltering as the air trapped in the body floated her high and her spinning tyres lost traction on the rock-strewn bottom.
"Oh, my God!" Jock cried
as a huge uprooted tree came hurtling down upon them out of the darkness. It crashed into the side of the truck, hitting one of the windows and slewing the whole chassis around. They were hurled downstream, spinning slowly under the weight of the floating tree. As they made one full revolution, the mortal embrace of the tree mass was broken. Released from its grip, they floated free, but they were sinking fast as the trapped air was expelled from the Land Cruiser's body. Water began to seep in, and soon they were sitting waist-deep.
"I'm getting out," Jock yelled, and threw his weight against the door. "It won't budge,"
he was panicking, as the pressure of water held the door tightly closed.
Then suddenly Daniel felt the wheels touch bottom again. The flood had swept them into a bend of the river and pushed them in against the far bank. The engine was still running. The modified air intake pipe and filter reached up as high as the cab roof. Daniel had installed it for just such an emergency. In the shallows, the wheels caught at the jagged rock bottom and heaved the Land Cruiser's bulk forward.
"Ah, come on, darling, come on," Daniel pleaded. "Get us out of here." And the sturdy truck responded. She shuddered and bounced and tried to drag herself from the waters. The headlights pushed through the surface and blazed out suddenly, lighting the far bank. The flood had cast them up on the shelving mud bank, and the truck cantered steeply nose up as her spinning front wheels clawed up the slope. Ahead of them was a low spot in the riverbank. The Land Cruiser slipped and slewed and crabbed up it, the engine roaring, ferociously tearing out small bushes that had survived the flood and ploughing deep ruts in the soft earth
until suddenly her lug tires gained full purchase and hurled her forward up out of the flood. Sheets of water streamed from her bodywork, like a surfacing submarine, and the big diesel engine bellowed triumphantly as they roared into the Mopani forest. "Oh, I'm alive," Jock whispered. "Hallelujah!" Daniel turned parallel with the riverbank, weaving the Land Cruiser back and forth between the tree trunks of the standing Mopani until they bumped over the verge onto the roadway. He kicked her out of low ratio and gunned the motor. They sped away towards the Mana Pool's turnoff. "How many more like that?" Jock asked with trepidation. For the first time since Johnny's death, Daniel smiled, but it was a grim little smile. "Only 4 or 5, he answered. "A Sunday afternoon stroll, nothing to it." He glanced at his watch. Cheng and the refrigerator trucks had almost 4 hours' start on them. They must have got through the fords before the drainage of storm waters off the slope of the escarpment had flooded them. The earth beneath the Mopani trees was melted like warm chocolate by the rain. This black cotton soil was notorious for bogging down vehicles when it was wet. The Land Cruiser slithered and laboured and left deep glutinous ruts behind the churning wheels. "Here's the next river," Daniel warned, and the road gradient altered, and thick dark riverine bush pressed in close on each side of the narrow track. "Get your life jacket on." "Oh, I can't stand another one like the last." Jock turned to him, pale-faced in the glow of the instrument panel. "I promised 10 Hail Marys and 50 Our Fathers. The price is right, it'll be a breeze," Daniel assured him as the headlights lit the ford.